nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
So I'd like to give you an introduction to a tool that is online. It's called Quantum.Lab. And I'm kind of assuming that you've listened to the seminar called Quantum Dots that I gave, and that is on the NanoHub as well, to give you an idea of where quantum mechanics kind of comes from and what quantum dots sort of are. And now we're going to dive into a little bit of what you can do with Quantum.Lab. So when you start with quantum mechanical type simulations or understanding, people write down this Schrodinger equation. And here I wrote down the time-independent Schrodinger equation, where there's a wave function psi, and you take a gradient, and you take the potential, and, sorry, it's the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. And what's known is that there's only a few problems that are really solvable. Like, you sit down with a pencil and paper and solve these things. And what's known, that's sort of the start of quantum mechanics, in a sense, you assume a Coulombic potential and look at a nucleus around an atom, and you consider a potential V as a function of 1 over R. So a potential gets softer and softer as further away you go from the core. Another problem that is explicitly solvable is a so-called particle in a box, where you say, I'm going to consider a box, and there's no potential inside, and the particle can't get out of the box. That's solvable. The other potential that's solvable is I'm going to assume a parabolic confinement, and that is analytically solvable. And the next one that's analytically solvable in the list here is a triangular potential, where there's a hard wall on the left and a triangular wall on the right, and the electron must be on the inside but can't get out. Now, people have spent a lot of time figuring out functions that actually solve that problem. We know this particle in the box one we're familiar with, that's a sine function. And I'll be talking about that in most of the presentation here. But the other potentials and wave functions that are known, this is so-called harmonic potentials, harmonic wave functions. And they solve this potential. And here is a Hunkel wave function that solves this harmonic oscillator potential. And these are called airy functions that are solving the triangular potential. I'm assuming that you've never heard of these functions before. And in fact, people have spent oodles of time deriving these functions and finding analytical forms for it. So it's not a trivial undertaking to define these functions. Yet you can write them down with pencil and paper on paper. You don't need a computer to solve that problem. But most problems that we solve in quantum mechanics really aren't solvable analytically anymore, because the potentials are more complicated than any of these varieties that I've shown here, and you use a computer to solve that problem. All right, so let's pick this one, particle in a box, and let's try to solve that. So here I wrote down now the time-independent Schrodinger equation. It has this partial derivative in one dimension now. We're just going to look at one dimension, look at a potential, and look at the eigenvalue problem, and solve for psi and solve for the energy. So let's have a little bit of intuition of what's going on. We're saying that the electron has to be inside of the system, and it cannot be outside. So it has to be between 0 and Lx. So we are assuming that the potential is 0 inside and it's infinite to the right. That means the wave function can be only non-zero on the inside and it must be 0 outside. Okay. So let's look at a potential solution, and I mentioned the sine and cosine function. And let's start with something that's called ansatz. You write down a guessed solution for a differential equation. And what we start out with saying is we're going to start with a wave function psi equals A times sine n pi over Lx times x. That means for x equal to 0, the wave function is 0. And for x equal Lx, the length of this quantum well, it's going to be sine of n pi. And sine of any n pi is 0. That means it's coming to 0 at the edges. All right, so the first wave function might look like this. So n equal to 1. And the next one is going to have a double lobe, a triple lobe, and a quadruple lobe. Right? So you plug in different numbers of n, and all of these wave functions at least are 0 at the edges of our domain, and we can say whatever you do on the inside, let's see whether that makes sense. But you also notice that there is a positive value and a negative value in these wave functions. So what does that mean? If we really wanted to describe a particle, we have to deal with positive quantities. So what we really are after in quantum mechanics, when we have a wave function, when we need to measure a particle and look at the density of electrons, we actually square that wave function. So we take psi square, and then we have functions that look like that. A single lobe that is coming to the zero at the edges, a double lobe, a triple lobe, and a quadruple lobe, etc. All right. For historical reasons, people often refer to the ground state that has a single lobe as an S-type wave function. Something that has a double lobe, people refer to as a P-type, D-type for 3, and F-type for 4. That has something to do with spectroscopy, pretty much when quantum mechanics was invented. When people started to look at light that comes out of atoms, they assign certain levels and certain symmetries. And people still use that notation. All right. So the next thing to understand is we assume that this is a wave function, so it's psi square equal a square sine square of n pi x over Lx. And what we want to do is we want to describe a particle in that. That means that particle is going to be distributed over space. But basically, we say somewhere the particle is in there. And we want to make sure that this wave function is normalized to a value of 1. That means the total integral value, the whole area under this curve needs to be 1. And how do we figure that out? Well, you can do that just by geometry. You can say you can lay this area shaded here, lay it over on the other side. That means you actually fill out this whole space by symmetry. And the whole area of this curve is the length of this box by 2 times the height a square. That means this normalization constant a that we didn't know about is square root of 2 over Lx. You can go about it in the hard way too and just do it with math, where you say I'm going to integrate my wave function over my space, and that value needs to be 1, so I'm going to plug in a square sine square nx n pi x over Lx. And I'm going to evaluate that integral, and I get a value of a square Lx over 2, which is just the same as what I wrote up there, just by geometry considerations, just by physical intuition. All right, so that means the normalization constant a is 2 over square root of 2 over Lx. All right, so here's a wave function now. That thing is now complete. We have the normalization, and we have all the constant we wanted to have, and we have an index n that can vary from 1 through infinity. And that wave function is valid in the range of 0 to x to Lx. All right, the next thing to do is take this wave function and plug it into the Schrödinger equation one more time to verify that this is actually a valid solution. So we'll do that. We'll plug this in. We assume that the potential is 0 in the inside of the quantum well and infinite outside. So we write down, we plug this psi into the equation here, and it gets to be lengthy, and you can read it right here. And you have terms that there's a sine, and a sine. It shows up 3 times, and the potential inside is 0. So here we can forget about the 0 potential. So we forget about this part. And then we have left with a coefficient times sine equals another coefficient times sine. If we want this to be true for any x that is in this expression here, then we need to cancel out the sine. So let's do that. So we get rid of that part, and we're left with the energy must be this coefficient. So that means that you have a closure relationship right here, where you have wave functions and you have eigenenergies that are associated with that differential equation. And what you find is that these energies are discrete. So if you plug in n equal 1, you get a single lobe. If you plug in n equal 2, you get a double lobe, 3, 4, and so on. And these are discrete energies. And people often just draw a line through these things, and then they often just forget about these wiggles. Okay? So then they talk about, these are my states in the system, right? Now, the next question is, what happens if you make this L large? So at the nanometer scale, we have things around 5 nanometers or 10 nanometers or so, and that these length scales are large, small compared to the wave function of the electron, length of the electron. If we now make this LX larger and larger, the energies are getting closer and closer. So if we make it 50 nanometers, these energies get very close. If we make it 50 centimeters, it is so densely packed you wouldn't even know what the true energy spacing is. So what that means is really at the macroscopic world, there is quantum effects, but they're all washed out because these discrete energies are so close to each other that you wouldn't be able to distinguish them. All right. So quantum mechanics is valid even at the macroscopic scale, but it's going to be hard for you to distinguish that. At the nanometer scale, these things of energy separation and state separation are coming to life. So let's ask what happens if you do this in three dimensions. I just showed you a single one-dimensional example. So we'll solve the Schrödinger equation in full three dimensions. So we write down pretty much the same equation, but do it for coordinates x, y, and z. And we'll do the same thing, that we assume this particle is now in a box that has length Lx, Ly, and Lz. And the particle must be inside, and the potential outside is infinite. It is not allowed there. So mathematically, we would set this potential V equal to infinity in the outside regions. And guess what? The solution is going to be rather similar, where we assume sine functions in x and y and in z. The normalization constants are identical to what I showed you in one dimensions, but you do it for three. And the eigenenergies are sums of these values like this. So you have nx over lx square, ny over ly square, and z over lz square. And that is all multiplied with one constant. So if you want to rederive that for x, y, and z, you can do that as an exercise. It's pretty simple. It's pretty much the same if you do it for x or y or z. You can take this wave function psi of nx and y and z and plug it into this Schrödinger equation up here, and you'll force that this eigenenergy has this form. All right. So let's consider a case where we make this box a perfect cube. So we make Lx, Ly, Lz equals to L. Okay? Just perfect cube. So then this expression gets a little simpler. We pull this L out of the expression here, so it's h bar squared pi squared over 2ml squared, and x squared and y squared and z squared are added. So you have a constant up front times nx squared plus ny squared and then z squared, and this is how the wave function looks. So the interesting thing is now you can plug in different quantum numbers. So you can take nx and y and z, and they're allowed to vary from 1 to infinity each. So let's plug in the number 1, 1, 1, and then the number 2, 1, 1, 1, 2, 1, 1, 1, 2. And then 1, 2, 2, 2, 1, 2, and 2, 2, 1. And then we'll do the same with 1s and 3s. And then you can compute what that constant k here is, or your normal, or the eigenenergy is a function of constant k. So if you have nx equal 1 and y equal 1 and z equal 1, you get 1 square plus 1 square plus 1 square, that is 3. So in the parenthesis, the value is 3. If we do 2, 1, 1, that's 6. If we do 1, 2, 1, that's 6. So you can tell you built these groups. So you have a group that is formed around 1, 1, 1. That's the so-called ground state. The next one is going to be a group of 3 that has a double lobe and x and single lobes and y and z and so on. So this is how these wave functions look. So here the ground state looks like a perfect ball. Then the next states up will have effectively a node in one direction, say x or y or z. And otherwise they have, if you look from any other direction, you just see a single ball or a single lobe. Does that make sense? Okay. And then if you were plotting things and for the higher axes, you would get just more complicated sets of balls and wave functions. All right. The interesting thing here is that these values here are degenerate, so-called degenerate. They have identical eigenenergy. Okay. So these are solutions of the system and at a constant energy. And you can provide multiple wave functions. So let's talk about another item that is very important in terms of applications of such quantum dots or physical insight. The way quantum mechanics, in a sense, was discovered was by seeing spectral lines that are discrete. What does that mean? People saw that there were, when they looked at light from something that was hot or was heated or was burning, that there were discrete lines coming out. So if you had a quantum dot or a quantum system like this, and you had an electron that sits at a higher energy, it could fall down to a lower energy and emit a photon. It could fall down from another energy and it will emit another photon. And if it falls down again, it emit another photon. And the key is that the energy of this photon is discrete, because these energies are discrete. The differences between these states are discrete. But the same, so anytime an electron drops down to another state, it could emit a photon. Or it needs to lose this energy by some other means. Either way, that energy needs to come out of the system. By the same token, an electron could absorb energy with a particular photon at a certain energy, and it could jump up in energy like this. All right? So if that happens, then you could have absorption. So these energy differences between these eigenstates are of importance to understand what light really could come out of such a system or what light could be absorbed by such a system. In other words, the absolute energy of these eigenstates is not really known anyhow, but you can only measure the differences between these states. So the transition energies are defined here as E and M, as the difference between EM minus EN, and that is then the photon energy, Planck's constant times the photon frequency. And that frequency is again discrete. So you need discrete energies to transition between states, and you can use that for light emission devices like LEDs or lasers that will emit light. You can do this for photodetectors that will absorb certain frequencies of light, and you'll detect the electrons otherwise. And at any other values, energy values, really nothing happens. This thing is transparent, so to speak, to other energies. Okay? So now there's a third caveat after we understood what the energies are and what the transitions between these energies are. The next thing is these states need to be occupied and empty in order for things to happen. So let me explain that a little bit. So the question is, in real quantum dots, is it possible for electrons to hop around to energy levels freely if you apply any transition energy? And the answer is no. Because there's a limited number of states at each energy level that are occupied and that are empty. So think about this. Here's a chair that's an available state, and there's an electron that is occupying that state, and there is this little bee that provides the source of energy. So let's assume you have a set of states that are at a lower energy. They're all occupied by these frogs, and there is an excited energy, and there's open states. So these guys, given some excitation, they can hop up there. All right, so you could have 100% excitation and 100% absorption if you shot in the light at the right frequency. All right, what if you had four states occupied on the bottom and two states occupied on the top and two states empty? Even though you come in with the same number of photons at the right frequency, all you can do is excite two electrons up because there's only two states open, right? So it's important to have final states open and initial states occupied, okay? All right, so you could only get 50% excitation or 50% absorption even though you punch this thing very hard and put in a lot of light at the right frequency, you wouldn't get as much as you... Yes?
When you had the previous slide where all four jumped up, do they stay there or do they have to come back down?
All right. So the question here is, how do electrons effectively come back down once they were up, right? So there's a variety of processes that can take electrons down. One would be light emission again, so they could emit the same light they absorbed. Or in physical systems, for example, in a quantum dot, the crystal by itself could be vibrating a little bit, and they can lose that energy, these electrons can lose energies to these vibrational modes of the system. So there's many other ways to fall back down, there's many other ways to come back up, and those are called so-called non-radiative processes. So the radiative process is where a photon radiates out or comes in, and then there's other processes.
So you don't necessarily have to have any in the lower level? So I was thinking that you had to have something in the lower level in order to have something in the higher level?
Generally, and we'll talk about that, this a statistical distribution of carriers that is determined by the so-called Fermi level that occupies states. And in equilibrium, states under the Fermi level are occupied, and states above the Fermi level are not occupied. Okay? So we'll get that in a little bit. So that's really the good question. It's a good lead-in. How is the occupancy given? It's described by the so-called Fermi-Dirac function. And that function looks like this. It's 1 over an exponential, and that exponential measures the energy difference against the Fermi level over K Boltzmann times temperature. And this function looks like this. At 0 Kelvin, so at absolute zero temperature, it's a step function. So it goes up to the Fermi level and is fully occupied. The system, all states are fully occupied to that level, and above that level they're completely empty. And as you ramp up the temperature a little bit, these states that are above the Fermi level are a little bit occupied, and the ones that are below the Fermi level, closely below, may be unoccupied. So they kind of leak out. Think of this as a sea of electrons that's bubbling a little bit. And the hotter you cook this thing, the more the bubbles go up and down, right? That's one way of looking at it. But deep in the sea, you have a lot of electrons. And way up in the air, you have very little electrons. But at that surface, dependent on the temperature, you can have a finite amount of electrons, even though they're above the so-called equilibrium Fermi level. All right, so let's make this a little bit more concrete on discrete eigenenergies. So if you have a nanostructure that has these properties where you say the energy levels are discretized, the device is operating at a finite temperature, so the Fermi level has some slope like this. And somehow, let's just assume we find a way that we keep the occupation pinned to this Fermi level. And we say we have three levels, E1, E2, and E3. E1 is heavily occupied at 90%, E2 is maybe at 80%, and E3 is at 10%, right? And let's assume that would be our world. There's no other states, and we pin those occupancies. So what we can have is really between those three states, we can have three different transition energies. We can hop from E1 to E2, from E1 to E3, or from E2 to E3. That's it. There's nothing else allowed in this world. And you notice that these arrows have different lengths, right? So that's what's going to make part of our absorption spectrum. And what you see here is if you go from E1 to E2, from E1 to E2, you go from a pretty heavily occupied state to a state that is reasonably well occupied as well. So there's not a whole lot of empty spots to hop into. So the absorption ought to be small. If you hop from E1 to E3, the occupation in E3 is pretty much empty. There's 90% of states available. So the absorption can be strong or large here. And for E2, E3 as well, the absorption can be large. So if you made an absorption measurement, you would find for this first transition, there's only a small absorption, and it's at a small energy because it's the smallest arrow. Then number three has the second smallest arrow, the middle arrow here. And its absorption will be a little bit smaller than the absorption with a long vector here, which goes from number one to number three. Just because if you go from number one to number three, there's a lot of states in E1, and there's hardly any states in E3. Right? So not only when you look at optical devices or quantum devices, do you need to understand what discrete states are, but you need to understand how they're occupied. That is, in a sense, what distinguishes very strongly electromagnetic type simulations that do where you use waveguides and things like that. Those also solve effectively very similar equations in terms of wave properties. If you have a waveguide, you have eigenmodes of a waveguide, etc. But in quantum mechanics and in solid state, you need to also consider whether those modes are occupied, and that's very important. All right. So let's try this, and you can go on the NanoHub, and you can go to this tool called quantum.lab. Here's the link, and I'll walk you through a couple of examples. So in quantum.lab, as you fire that up, you can do all kinds of different shapes, like a cube, like a pyramid, or an ellipsoid like this, and then you can compute these eigenstates rather easily, and that would be reasonably hard to do analytically, to do the eigenfunctions of an ellipsoid or a pyramid. So I'm going to walk you through a couple of examples that are pretty simple. So let's compute the first states in the gallium arsenide cubic quantum dot, where we set the lengths to Lx of 5 nanometers, Ly to 5.5, and Lz to 6. So we'll run this code on the NanoHub. You can select the number of states that you like. You can select the geometry of a box here. You can select the size of this quantum dot. And you can select the material that you want this quantum dot to be. And then you just hit the simulate button. It's pretty simple to operate this thing. And what you get is this. Here are these first states. Here's the ground state. It looks like a so-called S orbital. Here's a PZ orbital, is the second one, a PY orbital, a PX orbital, and then the next ones are up are combinations. Remember I showed you a table of, on the left this is 111, this is 112, 121, 211, and here is a 221 in the next one, and then there is another 122 probably, and then a 1, 2. Then you see a 3, 1, 1. All right? So you see combinations of these quantum states that are showing up. And you can visualize them rather readily in the quantum.lab. So as an exercise, I'll leave it to you to compute the first 20 eigenstates of an indium arsenide cubic quantum dot with these length scales, tabulate the corresponding eigenenergy values, and as a third exercise, compute the first 20 eigenstates of a permetal quantum dot, tabulate the eigenvalues, and look at the states and see whether you see something strange, and talk to your instructor about the symmetries of the states. Now let's look at optical properties. Let's shine light on this quantum dot. You can choose this different tab here called light source. You can change the location of the Fermi level in the system, the location, the temperature of the system, and you can change the angle that the light shines in terms of theta and phi. And you can sweep these certain properties like the theta angle between different values. And you can sweep theta, you can sweep phi, and you can sweep the Fermi level. And that'll give you ideas about the occupancies of the states and the sensitivity of a quantum dot against light. So I'm going to walk you through the dependencies against angles first. So I'm going to home in back to this example, the very first one of a cubic quantum dot of length 5 nanometers, 5.5, and 6 nanometers. We look at only four states for now, the first four, and I'm plotting them here. So you get, see again an S-like state, a PX, PZ, PY, and a PX state. There's a browser window in the tool that lets you look at this eigenenergy spectrum. You can read off these eigenenergies and tabulate them. And that means if we have four eigenenergies, we have allowed really six potential transition energies. So I have a table here where I wrote down E1, E2, E3, E4 on the horizontal axis, E1, E2, E3, E4 on the vertical axis. And if I want to transition from E2 to E1, that transition energy is now 1.5 eV, and that would correspond to a transition from a PZ orbital to an S orbital. So I wrote down PZ minus PS, minus S. If I want to transition from the third to the ground state, the transition energy E3 minus E1 is 1.8 eV, and that is a PY to S transition. And then we have PX to S is 2.15. If I now try to transition from PY to PZ, that transition energy is significantly smaller. It's 0.2 eV. If I go from E4 to E2, it's 0.5 or 0.6. And if I go from PX to PY, I go 0.3. So even though these energies here in this example, the absolute energies of these eigenstates are 3.3, 4.8, 5.1, and 5.4. These are relatively large energy numbers. The transitions between them are small, right? And that's what's sensitive to the light. So there's six potential photons that could come out of the structure or that could be absorbed. Yes?
Is it clear that if you were actually using a cubic, that each row would actually be the same energy?
Right. If it's a perfect cube, they should all have the same energy. So PX, PY, and PZ should be identical. And that's part of your homework exercise to work on that. All right? So now what I'm plotting here is the output of the quantum.lab that shows the X-polarized light going into the quantum dot, and it finds six transition energies. And these are the strengths of the transitions between these states. So here is PZ to S at 1.55. The next one is PY to S at 1.8, right here. And the next one is PX to S at 2.15. And then on the bottom left, you now have PY to PZ Py to Bz at 0.26, next one at Px to Pz at 0.5, and then in between here you have Px and Py. So we can identify just these numerical solutions against these optical transitions. And what you notice is that 5 out of these 6 values are of the order of 10 to the minus 20. Very small values, right, on the logarithmic scale. And there's one that's very high, that's of the order of 10 to the minus 4 or so. So that one is actually an allowed transition. And I haven't explained to you what allowed means and why. And there's 6 with X-polarized light that are not allowed. So let's ask ourselves, what does that mean, being allowed, or where does this come from? But let's just state for now that this out of these 6, this one here, the Px to S, is allowed to absorb light polarized in the X direction. All others are pretty much forbidden. Now if we look at absorption in the Y direction, we see it's again 6 lines like this, and one of them has a strong peak, the others are pretty flat somewhere in the noise. That's really numerical noise that you're seeing here. And this value here corresponds to Py and S. So for Y polarized light, I can have absorption from Py to S. So we'll make a Y there in this table. And all others are not allowed. You can almost guess, right, if we take Z polarized light and shine that in the structure to Pz minus S, to S, that one is allowed right here. These others are not allowed. So what in this transition table of 6 potential transitions, only certain light of a certain polarization can connect certain states. All right? It so happens that the transition from S to Pz can be responsive to Z polarized light. Py to S can be sensitive to Y polarized light. And Px to S to X polarized light. What's this polarization? That's the vector of the electric field in the electromagnetic spectrum. That's the direction of the electric field. So in other words, these other 3 transitions here, Py, Pz, Px, Pz, Px, Py, are really dark. You wouldn't be able to see them. All right, so let's translate that to something you could potentially measure. Let's assume that this Fermi, that the ground state here, the S-like state, is occupied, and these other states are unoccupied. So we set the Fermi level to 0. Which means in this nomenclature, the ground state is occupied. And what we do here is we shine light at a 0-degree angle. That corresponds to Z polarized light. And we actually see indeed one absorption peak here. If we now sweep the angle from 0 to phi, we'll pick up this is mislabeled here, sorry. We'll pick up another peak. So as we sweep from 0 to 90 degrees, we pick up a peak that comes from X polarized light down to Pz polarized light right here. Now if we rotate the incoming light slightly to 45 degrees, but still coming the polarization to 45 degrees, but coming vertically anyhow, and we sweep the angle of theta, we'll pick up all 3 peaks. So if you come in with a relatively arbitrary angle with arbitrary polarization, you see a lot of peaks. And we can identify them all, and we don't see any response to these peaks that corresponds to Py, Pz, Px, Pz, and Px, Py. All right? So what happens? Now, I made this example rather simple, where I only consider 3 states and only the ground state is occupied. The interesting thing now is, what if you look at more states in the system? If you look at 20 states overall in the system, so you consider a higher range of this ladder, you can compute a lot of potential transition energies and a lot of allowed transitions. So there's more, and these are the two that I'm indicating here that we had before. So this is the result before we had phi of 45 degrees and theta of 0, and we have 20 states in light, in the lighter color here. We have the original absorption, and then we find more absorption to much higher energies that are also going to be allowed, because we included higher states that the light could, the electrons could go to. Now, if we also ramp up the Fermi level to higher energies where all four of these lower states are occupied, we uncover many more peaks and have a much more complicated absorption spectrum. So again, what you see here is an interplay between which states are occupied, which states are allowed to have transitions, and what are the transition energies. So pretty much conclude now this overview, and then we can look at the screens and play with this. I would ask you to look at a pyramidal quantum dot, and as a project, try to design this pyramidal dot that it has the highest absorption around 1 EV. So you can go in the lab and start playing with that and design the structure so you have an absorption of 1 EV. Then you can ask, how does the absorption change as a function of incident angle? And what happens if you change the Fermi level to 1 EV? Please describe that then verbally, give graphs, you can download the graphs, etc. And what happens if you include more than 20 states in this design in your calculation? Right, then I designed something for extra credit, which I consider relatively hard to do because I didn't talk much about it. Simulate a cubic quantum dot where you set two axes identical to, so Lx equal Ly to 5 nanometers and Lz to 6 nanometers. What happens to the Px and Py states? And what happens to the Lz state? Again, plot it, show it on paper in your report, and discuss what you see. Then do it for Lx equal to Lz and leave Ly different and see what happens. You might see a trend there. Describe the trend you see. And then finally, set Lx to Ly to Lz. And what happens to Px, Py, and Pz states? Describe it and try to explain it. There's actually something mathematically very interesting going on that's dealing with degenerate states. And then finally, go to Wikipedia or another resource and try to explain what absorption, why absorption lines might be forbidden and others might be allowed, and write a small description of that. It's not very hard, it's not mathematically intensive, but I didn't want to fit that in this presentation here. Right? So I think that's it.
All right. Any questions?
Must be completely clear, right?
I have a question about when you're setting the Fermi level. You said that, and for our purposes, 0 EV was filling the base level. And then you arbitrarily set it to 2.2 to fill all four. Is there a relationship we should see between that when we're using the program on how many are filled?
Yeah. So the way you look at this, the program operates such that if the Fermi level is set to zero, it is set to the ground state of the system, all right? So if you have a state, no chalk, yes. Oh, there's chalk. So you have a state ladder. So here's E1, and E2, E3, E4. And then by default, you have a Fermi function that looks like this. So it's 1 here, and at 0 Kelvin, so this is 1, So for 300 Kelvin, you have a little bit of a leak in this Fermi C, okay? But it turns out, so this is at the ground state, this is at E1, and that means for the Fermi level at zero. So if you want these states here to be occupied, so it can, they can also go to some excited states, so if you want the Fermi function to be this, then you need to set the Fermi level to cover this energy at least, okay? And a priori, if you didn't know what that spacing was, it would be hard, so you probably have to run the first simulation, see where the spectrum is, and then raise the Fermi level up.
And that's on the Fermi level of the material?
So. Right, exactly. Okay? So if you want to occupy these guys, you have to at least raise the Fermi level up by this much. Or you crank up the temperature, right? So it, the interesting thing is, well, the number to remember is K Boltzmann T at 300 Kelvin, which is room temperature, is 25 millielectron volt, or 0.025 EV, right? So if you have a gap here, from here to here, that is 1.5, right? Like what's here in this list, roughly, right? The first one shows up at 1.5. That means this thing is completely and utterly empty. Right, on this scale of things, this function looks like this. Right, there is nothing that is occupied up in the upper states. So you'd have to shift the Fermi level somewhere in there. Okay? Does that make sense?
I also wanted to ask you real quick, the material that you make these quantum dots out of, and how does that affect these energy levels?
Okay, excellent question. So, kind of glossed over this. Yeah, we can talk about how you build these things and how the effective mass affects it, so or the material affects it. So I didn't talk about this constant much. This is an effective mass. What's an effective mass? So if you were calculating this for a hydrogen atom where you actually didn't have a particle in a box type problem, but like this Coulombic potential, this mass would be 1. Okay, just like an electron mass. If we build this, we can actually build these things in a solid, these quantum dots, and I'll talk a little bit about how you build them, etc. Then this M effective mass is sort of representative of the material itself. It's a material property. So gallium arsenide has a certain effective mass, indium arsenide has a different effective mass. So different effective masses will give you different H bar over 2m, right? And where does this enter? Here in the eigenenergy, right? So if the eigenenergy En is a function of 1 over m, okay? So the difference between Em and En is also a function of 1 over m. So if you can make that M bigger, the spacing is going to be smaller. If you make the N light, spacing is going to be bigger. All right? So that gets me thinking a little bit in this example, right? So here I explain that as you make things physically bigger, this L becomes larger and these states get closer, right? Well, macroscopically, you also make things heavier, right? You're talking about a car, 1,000 kilograms, right? That means that 1,000 kilograms goes here and makes that energy spacing also very small, right? So the heavier things get, the closer the spacing, the quantum spacing is. The lighter they are, the more far apart they are, right? So different materials give you different masses, and that's... It's not the physical mass that you actually set there. It's the electron mass that the electron sees of its surrounding crystal. Okay? All right?
Yeah, if you have time, if you walk us through the program. Do you have any commercial people trying to use your program to develop quantum paths?
Not really. A lot of that is, in a sense, in the research realm, and then some groups are building lasers now and detectors. But it's not a big commercial world yet, where there's a lot of people doing that. Before I go in the tool, I want you to give you a sketch on the board real quick on how people build these things. So people have experimental workers. They can take a wafer of gallium arsenide and they can literally grow one atomic layer after the another. Think of making a sandwich and you can lay down Legos that are of the order of one atom at a time and you can build layers. Okay? So gallium arsenide has a certain lattice constant, so A equals 0.56 nanometers. This is how far these atoms would like to be placed from another. Nothing more, nothing less. So Lego, right? Then they grow on top, for example, indium arsenide. But indium arsenide has a lattice constant of 5.9, I believe. Okay? So what you end up doing is, so underneath you sort of have a mesh of atoms like this. A crystal, think of it as Legos, quite similar, and you try to put something on top that would rather be bigger, like this. Okay? So what happens is that there's, for a few atomic layers, they actually do align themselves here with each other, but the boxes get a little bit taller. I'm going to exaggerate it a little bit. Okay? Just because they're squeezed in this direction, they're going to go up in this direction. And you do that for a couple of atomic layers, and then these guys are fed up with it. They'd say, that's too hard. It's too much strain on the system. What they end up doing is they build little clumps like this. So instead of building nice layers, they build clumps, but each clump is a perfect crystal. And then people grow on top, again, gallium arsenide. So you have one material enclosed by another material. And that's your particle in a box. And people build that. And typical dimensions in this direction are 10 to 30 nanometers. And directions here are 5 dimensions here to 10 nanometers. So these are real things. These are not imaginary particle in the boxes. When I took quantum mechanics 30 years ago, this was just a nice mathematical exercise to go through of what I showed you today. But today we can actually build these things. Okay?